dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who has given much to our understanding and to the, well, quality of the fight we are mounting in that war, I'm very pleased to say, is joining us for a full hour of conversation about his own work and the environment in which we need it more than ever. He is Kenneth Timmerman. He is, among other things, the president and CEO of the Foundation for Democracy in Iran, an organization that, under his leadership, was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize in 2006. He is the author of numerous books of both fiction and nonfiction, the most recent of which is Deception: The Making of the YouTube Video, Hillary and Obama Blamed for Benghazi. He is also a very prolific contributor to the public policy debate through his contributions to a variety of periodical journals and blog posts and the like, and it is always a delight to have him with us to talk, especially for a full hour at some length about the work he's doing, as I say, and the work that needs to be done. Kenneth Timmerman, we catch up with you in France, where you are vacationing. Thank you for taking some time to talk to us. It's good to catch you.
Thank you, Frank. It's a pleasure to be on with you. And it's exciting, actually, to be here now as we go into the second round of these French elections, too.
Well, I do want to talk about what's happening in France at the moment. But before we get to that, I think it's important that we cover one of your very, very considerable areas of expertise and passion, and that is Iran. We're speaking the day after the United States Senate, by a vote of 98-2, voted to adopt a raft of new sanctions against that country, which, of course, is athwart the spirit, if not in every respect, the letter of the Iran deal. I think of it as the Obama bomb deal. Ken, let's do some stock taking on what's going on in Iran. Here we are, better part of 2 years after President Obama launched us on this experiment with Iran. How would you characterize, for starters, the proposition that we have nipped in the bud, spared the world the threat of an Iranian nuclear weapon?
A very dangerous illusion, and that was the illusion that former Secretary of State John Kerry and Obama sold not just to the American people, or tried to sell the American people, but they tried to sell it to the Europeans quite successfully because the Europeans, led by the Germans and the French, were very eager to get back into Iran to do business there in the oil and gas industry, in the power generation industry, and various infrastructure projects. Here's the single worst thing about the Iran deal, Frank, is that it allows the Iranian regime to develop fifth-generation centrifuges completely above board, completely legally, declared to the IAEA. Nobody can stop them. They're allowed to procure equipment for them and everything. And fifth-generation centrifuges will essentially cut the time that Iran needs to produce a weapon's worth of highly enriched uranium from something like 6 months down to approximately 3 weeks. So we've gone from Iran being 6 months from the bomb to Iran being 3 weeks from the bomb, thanks to the Iran nuclear deal. And that's something that nobody can deny. And Secretary Kerry, former Secretary Kerry himself, has acknowledged that the Iranians will have these new capabilities. But he says that's better than the alternative, which he claims was war. And we've seen just this week, and I'm sure you want to get into this more, but we've seen just this week Kerry going around Europe claiming that our Arab allies and were begging the Obama administration to bomb Iran, and it was only thanks to John Kerry and Barack Obama that they averted some kind of terrible war catastrophe. I think that's just a false, it's a straw man argument. It was never going to happen, and it was not in the cards.
Yeah. Well, more to the point, as you understand as a serious student of history, Ken Timmerman, we probably have simply postponed a terrible day of reckoning and greatly increased the associated dangers by having given the Iranians the time and the latitude that you've just described in terms of these centrifuges and reducing the lead time to having actual weapons. And Ken, I think we have to just also stipulate that that's, in a way, the best case. That's what they can do without violating the agreement. You follow these things very closely, Ken. Given what we are hearing from the so-called Iranian opposition, the various experts in the field are warning of, what's your own assessment of how likely it is that the Iranians are, at this moment, actually fully complying with both the letter and spirit of this agreement?
Well, it's hard to say, Frank, because they have always had an underground program, an underground nuclear program, and literally an underground ballistic missile program. They recently announced a third underground ballistic missile manufacturing and stockpile center. So we don't know what we don't know. We do know that they have sites that they have not declared to the IAEA, to the international community. Obviously, we don't necessarily know where they are. I would hope that the U.S. intelligence community has satellite intelligence that is able to localize them, but they've not made that information public. So publicly, we don't know whether the Iranians are violating or not violating the agreement. And just one of the problems with this is that the IAEA, under pressure from Obama and Kerry, decided in December 2015 to close the so-called military file. And this was the possible military applications of Iran's nuclear research. And they said, okay, we're just going to close that file. We're not going to look into it any longer. We're not going to try to find out what the Iranians were actually trying to do when they were building triggers for nuclear weapons, for example, or lenses for nuclear weapons. We're just going to shut that whole file, pretend it doesn't exist, and that their whole program has only civilian applications. So we're really in the dark.
Can you mention missiles? There was a lot of talk when the deal was under negotiation, and particularly when it was being sold in a fashion to the United States Congress, that it somehow was going to restrict the Iranian missile program, which, let's face it, basically has no other purpose for being other than delivering nuclear weapons over distances sufficient to attack, the little Satan, as the Iranians call it, the State of Israel, or the great Satan, us. What's the latest on the Iranian missile program, other than that they're apparently manufacturing more of them in underground places?
Right, and they don't care about what we say. They don't care about what the Obama administration claims were their commitments under the nuclear deal. They have violated those repeatedly, egregiously, openly, with effrontery, testing long-range missiles again and again and again. And that's one of the things that prompted the U.S. Senate to pass these new sanctions against Iran, because the missile programs are run by the Revolutionary Guards Corps, the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps in Iran. And the IRGC was finally put on the terrorism list by Congress this past week, something that many Democrats had been very hesitant to do. When Obama was in office, they refused to place the IRGC on the terrorism list because Obama and Kerry were telling them that, well, actually, we have to deal with the IRGC, and they are a force of rationality in the Iranian regime. They are a force of exporting the revolution. They are a force of carrying out terrorist attacks around the world. They are the ones who blew up our embassy in Beirut. They are the ones who can constantly provide explosively formed penetrators to Sunni terrorist groups in Iraq and in Taliban and the Taliban in Afghanistan, with the you of killing American troops. So it's a very good thing that the IRGC was finally placed on the terrorism list. That is going to have a potentially big impact on their economy economy, since they control a lot of Iran's oil industry, and they are involved with many European companies who could get sanctioned under this new law.
Ken Timmerman, we are going to be back to discuss a lot of what you've just touched on there in more detail in a moment. Stay tuned for what the IRGC might mean for you right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back in this very special extended interview with Kenneth Timmerman, a man that I have admired and been proud to collaborate with over a long period of time, notably, but not exclusively, in his capacity as the president and CEO of the Foundation for Democracy in Iran, an organization he founded to help bring about democracy in Iran against very, very long odds. He is the author of numerous important books, and I want to commend to you a couple of them: Shadow Warriors, Traitors, Saboteurs, and the Party of Surrender, for one, and his most recent, Deception, the making of the YouTube video, Hillary and Obama, blamed for Benghazi. So, Ken, you've set the predicate a bit for what's going on in Iran itself. I'd like to talk a bit about what it's doing that is of increasing concern to us as it projects power. Perhaps we could start with what seems to be an inexorably ratcheted up level of aggressiveness towards the United States Navy in the Persian Gulf. There are reports that a marine helicopter has been lased, which is a very dangerous thing, needless to say. It could blind the pilot, for example, and put the aircraft in jeopardy. Ships are making what seem to be not just psychological attacks on vessels passing through the Strait of Hormuz, but perhaps dress rehearsals for the real thing, and on and on. Talk about what that portends, Ken, as you see it.
Well, Frank, the Iranian Navy, the regular Navy, and the IRGC Navy have really spent the past 15 years beefing up their aggressive military capabilities. You mentioned lazing helicopters. That is a new tactic, maybe something they'd learned from the Russians. The Russians have used that against us in the past. And you're right, it has very dramatic impact on the pilots. It can blind them or cause severe neurological damage for years and years following the attack. They have worked on these so-called swarming attacks, where they come with dozens of small fast boats against a large, either a destroyer or a aircraft carrier or some large surface vessel, and you never know which one might be packing a suicide bomb on board. They have also acquired a lot of surface-to-sea missiles from the Chinese, silkworms and others, including a missile which the Chinese claim is capable of tracking an aircraft carrier while it is in motion at high speed on the seas, guided by an aircraft overhead. And this is something the Chinese experimented a couple years and that they exported to the Iranians about 2 years ago. So these capabilities are growing. They are preparing for an eventual conflict with the United States in the Strait of Hormuz. And I think that what we're seeing are dress rehearsals. I think you're absolutely right about that.
Yeah. Ken, you also are very much alive to the efforts that the Iranians are making to extend hegemony over other parts of the Middle East, from the Yemen civil war with their support for the Houthi rebels there, up to a, well, what's been called a Shiite crescent that they seem to be trying to carve out in Syria and Iraq and Lebanon. What is the game here, and how far advanced is it as you read it now?
Well, the game is as you say, to create a Shiite crescent, to create an arc of instability, and to cement areas where Iran has absolute dominance, the Shiite areas of Lebanon. The Syrian regime, which is not Shiite per se, but the Alawites are a kind of renegade sect which gets assimilated into world Shiadom. They see Shiite allies potentially in Saudi Arabia. This is, by the way, one of the great sources of their conflict with Saudi Arabia, is that the Iranians for many years have been secretly providing aid to dissident clerics in the Shiite community in Saudi Arabia, all of them based near oil exporting terminals and cities in the eastern province in particular. So the Iranians have been fomenting trouble and subversion wherever they can go, but they've had new capabilities over the past 2 years, and they've been far more aggressive, committing tens of thousands of troops in both Yemen and Syria to the battlefield. This is something they haven't done in the past, and it's a new development that is going to put them in direct confrontation, potentially, with American soldiers, especially in Syria.
Yeah, I hear that they're getting very close now to being in contact of the violent kind. Ken, as you look at this, I know you're concerned about what the Iranians have done to extend their influence and, in fact, for all intents and purposes, it seems, their control of the Iraqi military and much of the country, the militias and so on that they've been arming and deploying nominally in the interest of taking down the Islamic State, something we've been collaborating on. Some have said we've been providing an air force for the Iranian troops on the ground in Iraq now. Where does this lead, do you think?
Well, the Iranians see Iraq as a vassal state. All right, there's no other way of putting it. They regularly attend cabinet meetings. They have their agents inside every Iraqi cabinet ministry. The head of the Quds Force, Qasem Soleimani, who's the military leader, the Iranian military commander, both in Iraq and in Syria, he regularly tours the battlefield, gets himself photographed with the troops. He's something. He's like a folk hero. You know, he's the General Douglas MacArthur of the Iranian Revolution, right? And he goes around the battlefield getting himself photographed, shaking people's hands and rubbing his hands on their head and whatever. But he is a real force on the ground. He's not just a general. He is a political figure close to the Kurds in northern Iraq, the Kurds who are, again, our allies on the ground. But he exerts a tremendous amount of influence over them, both politically and through fear of what he could do to them militarily or through terrorist attacks, should they not be compliant with his wishes.
I assume it is safe to say, Ken, based on your close study of all of this, that there isn't an aspect of Iranian activities, either military or terroristic or hegemonistic or political in character, that hasn't benefited immensely from the Obama bomb deal's windfall transfer of, by some estimates, at least $150 billion to the regime, including billions in cash on pallets secreted into the place in the dark of night. I wonder, as you take stock of all of that, quickly, if you could just say a word about how the bet has played out for President Obama, who made much of the fact that this was going to conduce to more moderation. The re-election of Rouhani is said to be an example thereof. Talk about that quickly, if you would.
Yeah, the only thing I could say about Obama is that he's not the only one to delude himself and delude the American public with this idea of the mysterious Iranian moderate. Rouhani is in bed with the Supreme Leader Khamenei. He is in bed with Qasem Soleimani, the leader of the Quds Force. They do not have different agendas. Here's the difference between an Iranian radical or hardliner and Iranian moderate. The hardliner will chop your head off first, then he'll rob you. The moderate, first he'll take your money, and then he'll kill you.
He'll kill you. Heads come off either way. Ken Timmerman, a very graphic way of describing what we're up against, and I think entirely apt. When we come back, we're going to talk with Ken about Qatar, apparently another Iranian ally, and another problem for us. But you wouldn't know it from the way the Pentagon's behaving at the moment. That and more, straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. Ken Timmerman is in the house, well, at least in a metaphorical sense of the word. He's actually in the south of France, which is a splendid place to be. Wouldn't we all like to be with Ken at the moment? But he's with us through the miracle of radio, and I'm very grateful to him for giving us a full hour of his time on vacation to talk about some of the most important issues and developments we are facing at the moment, notably, but not exclusively, in the Middle East, an area in which he is deeply, deeply knowledgeable. Ken, we talked a little bit about what the Iranians are doing in the Middle East. There is a sense, I gather, among many in the Arab world, that what they also are up to is making inroads with one of the Arab states that is supposedly on our side, Qatar. Give us a read on what's happening with the Qataris. Whose side are they actually on? And what is the implication of their being actually, in one form or another, aligned with our Iranian foes?
All of those are very good questions. And the Qataris have long been an enigma to many. They have been supporting Hamas. They've been supporting the Taliban. They've been supporting the Islamic State. They've been supporting Sunni terrorist groups around the world.
The Muslim Brotherhood.
The Muslim Brotherhood as well. And recently, the Saudis and the Emiratis cut off diplomatic and economic ties with them because of this, because they had paid a ransom to the Islamic State of close to $1 billion to release 35 or 38 of their citizens.
$1 billion? For the hostages?
Yes, close to $1 billion in ransom. Now, Frank, they got a better deal than we did. We paid $1.7 billion to get five hostages out. They paid about $1 billion to get 38 out. So, you know, per head, they were better negotiators than John Kerry and President Obama. But nevertheless,
that would not have been difficult to do, would it?
It would not have been difficult to do. Yeah. So here's the problem with Qatar is that the United States Air Force has our largest base in Qatar. Okay. And that, I think, is what motivated, wrongly in my opinion, but what motivated the Pentagon to sign a $12 billion arms deal, Air Force deal with them just this past week. I think it was a mistake. The timing was horrible to do it now, but we would have to relocate that airbase in Qatar. Now, the Qataris are very smart about this. They're trying to buy the U.S. administration with a $12 billion arms deal and get us to not back our Saudi and Emirati allies in the fight against ISIS in their leverage against Qatar. So, you know, we're, in a sense, we're being played by both sides here. And so far, I would say we haven't gotten it, in my opinion, we haven't gotten it quite right. I would tend to come down more on the Saudi side in this. I think the Qataris, because of their close alliance with Iran, because of their economic ties with Iran, because of their double dealings, I think, on intelligence issues with Iran, I think we should be putting the squeeze on the Qataris and not selling them weapons.
This is doubly peculiar because, as you know, Ken Timmerman, the president himself recently expressed a very considerable concern about what the Qataris are up to and sympathy with those who are trying to bring it to heel. One aspect of which is, as I understand it, Ken, the presence in Qatar itself of Iranian forces. Are you hearing that as well?
Well, I'm not aware of actual Iranian military forces in Qatar, but they could be there. But you know, there's so few Qataris in the country. There's certainly more. If you've ever been to Doha and walked around the market, you know, you can hardly find a Qatari in the market. It's all full of Pakistanis and Filipinos and Indians and whatever. So they have a virtually non-existent population, and yet they have an outsized influence because of things like Al Jazeera, the television network, which broadcasts Muslim Brotherhood anti-Semitic, anti-American hatred 24/7 in Arabic, and they have these efforts to provide political, diplomatic, and economic support to the Muslim Brotherhood and other terrorist groups. So they have chosen that as their signature agenda, rather than, oh, I don't know, raising wheat in the desert, for example, or producing Nobel Peace Prize diplomats.
Ken, on that point about what sort of problematic behavior the Qataris engage in, I would like to make sure we don't neglect one other facet, which is a basically economic warfare phenomenon, namely the use of their sovereign wealth fund to throw their weight around in certain circles. Our friend Kevin Freeman has concluded that they indeed were involved in an effort to take down Wall Street back in September of 2008. It's a fascinating tale, and I commend everyone, in addition to Ken Timmerman's terrific books, Kevin Freeman's Secret Weapon, which chronicles that that tale. Ken, let me ask you to sort of bring in one of the other players now in the Middle East, increasingly, thanks in part to President Obama, namely the Russians, very active in Syria, but trying obviously to extend their influence in other parts of the region. The Russians were, as you mentioned earlier, I think, included in this legislation adopted overwhelmingly, almost unanimously by the Senate yesterday, subjecting them to sanctions that President Obama, ironically, saw fit to impose late in his term. But what is the state of play, as you see it, with respect to the Russians, specifically with respect to the Middle East, but perhaps more broadly as well?
Well, Obama essentially, by creating a vacuum in the Middle East and by refusing to assert the American presence, not domination, but the American presence in the Middle East, essentially opened the door to the Russians. And I can remember, Frank, in the 1980s when you were in the Pentagon and I was in Paris as a defense correspondent looking at the Middle East, the story was, well, the Russians are looking for warm water ports. They have Latakia in Syria. That's it. And they're being blocked by the United States. Well, they're not being blocked by the United States any longer. They have developed very good relations with Egypt, even under General al-Sisi, because Obama shunned al-Sisi, so al-Sisi went to Moscow. They have great relations with the Syrians. They have very good relations with the Iranians, and they are building ports, military facilities, basing their aircraft in Syria, doing things that show a, an almost imperialistic Russia that we haven't seen in many decades.
Imperialistic does seem to me to be about right. They have just taken credit for having killed Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi in an airstrike in Syria. Ken Timmerman, what do you make of that? And if, in fact, they accomplished it, does that materially change the order of battle?
It's an interesting story, Frank, because that airstrike, we're told, took part at the end of May, so several weeks ago, and we have not seen any impact on the ground from the airstrike, right? However, what's very interesting is to look at the different versions, the Russian version versus the kind of local version or the Syrian opposition version. The Syrian opposition said the airstrike took place outside of Raqqa, 13 civilians were killed in buses coming to a meeting. The Russians' version said the airstrike hit a meeting of top ISIS leaders, killed at least 30 top leaders and 300 other fighters. the Russians ascribed this massive, massive casualty count to a big airstrike based on intelligence where they had this meeting of ISIS leaders under surveillance. If it is true that they wiped out essentially much of the top military leadership of ISIS, I would suspect that we will see the results on the ground in the Battle of Raqqa and in the inability of ISIS to regroup afterwards.
A drama that is still playing out, needless to say. I know you will be following it closely, Ken Timmerman, as will we, with your help, among others. Ken, we're going to pause for one last break, and when we come back, I want to switch gears and ask you to talk a little bit about what's going on inside this country at the moment and how it bears on both our domestic political scene and our foreign policy. That and much more with Ken Timmerman, the author of Deception, the making of the YouTube video Hillary and Obama blamed for Benghazi. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We are completing this very important conversation with one of the most astute observers of international political and strategic affairs, most especially with respect to the Middle East, but also very much with an eye to what is going on in our own country. He is Kenneth Timmerman. He has been an investigative reporter for numerous publications. One of my favorites back in the day was Insight magazine of the Washington Times. But he has contributed in formidable ways for decades through both his writings in the periodical literature and also his terrific books, a number of them bestsellers, that have really incredibly important insights into the challenges we face as a country. Let me turn to the domestic scene with you, Ken, if I may. We have a pretty good fix, I think, now on a number of the challenges the country is facing internationally. But what are we to make, as you see it now from some remove, of the Clinton affair and now the Trump affair and one of the prominent figures in both, namely James Comey, the now sacked director of the Federal Bureau of Investigations. Remind us of the role he played in the first of those, and let's then turn to what he's doing at the moment.
Well, Comey was the one, of course, who announced that there was a criminal investigation. He was instructed by then Attorney General Loretta Lynch to call it a matter, not an investigation, a matter under investigation of Hillary Clinton's misuse of her private email server and mishandling of classified information. And ultimately, he determined in July, just before the elections, that there would not be any prosecution. That was not his role as the director of FBI to make that determination, but he did. And it was a pretty clear insertion by himself into the political process. I think, frankly, James Comey has shown himself to be he is the center of the universe as far as he is concerned. I used to call him a Boy Scout, and friends of mine involved in scouting said, please don't malign the scouting movement. He's not a Boy Scout. He's an egotist. He thinks that he is the most important person in the world. He's the only one who is incorruptible. And his account that he gave last week in his testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee of his meetings with Donald Trump was absolutely hallucinogenic, completely nutty, frankly. Somebody who has lost touch with reality, lost touch with his role as the director of FBI, and frankly, President Trump couldn't have fired him soon enough, in my opinion. Now you've got Bob Mueller, who's a very close crony of Jim Comey, heading up this, you know, investigation at the FBI as special counsel, and reports are he is all of the staff that he has hired are Democrat operatives. He hasn't hired a single Republican. He hasn't hired a single, you know, unengaged or disengaged or neutral observer. He's hired a bunch of Democrat political hacks on his staff. That does not bode well for the President of the United States.
Indeed, it does not. And before we get to, you know, the hiring and the pursuit of various aspects of the investigation, Ken, let me just ask you, it would appear to me, based on a plain reading of the regulations of the Department of Justice, which govern whether someone conducting an investigation can pursue that investigation if he or she has close personal ties to a subject of the investigation or someone simply involved in the investigation. And there's no getting around it. That is certainly true of James Comey. He's up to his eyeballs in this matter, if I can use that expression, of the president's, well, it's seemingly not his collusion with the Russians. I think that's pretty much over the side. But now this question of whether he obstructed justice in one fashion or another, either before he fired James Comey as FBI director or for doing so. If indeed, as you say, these two men are very long-time, close personal and professional friends as well as colleagues, it would certainly seem to me, Ken, that Bob Mueller cannot possibly pursue this investigation in an objective and independent fashion, as he is supposed to. Am I missing something here?
No, I think you're right. And unfortunately, it looks also that we're stuck with him, that he is going to be conducting this investigation, and it will turn into a witch hunt. You know, what's extraordinary here is to even the very notion of investigating President Trump for obstruction of justice in a so-called attempt to shut down the Russia investigation. Guess what has not been shut down or affected in any way? The Russia investigation. So where is the obstruction of justice? He has had no impact on that investigation whatsoever. So the very premise of Mueller's investigation seems to be flawed.
And highly selective, to say the least. The indignation on the part of so many, it seems, Democrats over all of these allegations is one that turns a complete blind eye towards their own culpability, some significant number of them at least, in various activities with the Russians, including some, like President Obama's involvement trying to get some space from Vladimir Putin, as you remember, Ken, in 2012, in the midst of a presidential election. So these sort of highly selective investigations, if you want to call them that, are troubling before you get to this conflict of interest. But the conflict of interest is particularly worrying in the case of Bob Mueller and James Comey. So, Ken, where do you think this goes from here? I mean, I'm obviously asking you to look into a crystal ball, and yours may not be any better than the rest of ours, but you've been following politics and these sorts of intrigues for many, many years, and I'd welcome your thoughts.
Well, Frank, here's what I think is going on politically, and I think this really is all about politics. It's about the 2018 midterm elections. The Democrats, Chuck Schumer foremost among them, are absolutely terrified going into 2018 because they have 10 U.S. senators, Democrats, who are up for re-election in states that Donald Trump won by double digits. 10. If the Republicans just pick off 6 of them, they have an absolute majority in the Senate of 60 votes. The Democrats are terrified of this. So their entire strategy, and I think naming Mueller, although he's named by Rod Rosenstein, supporting Mueller's investigation, their entire strategy is to bloody Donald Trump as much as possible to make sure that he succeeds in absolutely nothing that he does, so that they have some hope of not being beaten resoundingly in the 2018 elections. And opposing that, I would say the president's best weapon and his best strategy is exactly what he's doing now, is keep lining up the achievements, keep the economic ball rolling, keep the job growth continuing, keep companies coming back to the United States, repatriating their profits, keep the stock market going up. And if he keeps all those things happening in the economy and gives us a tax program and gets the bill, the repeal and replace Obamacare bill passed, he'll win the 2018 elections and all this will be over.
These are troubling times. I think the damage being done to President Trump and to his young presidency is having repercussions for both our national interests and our national security. And your insights into all of these matters is greatly appreciated, Ken. Again, thank you for finding some time on your vacation to talk with us. We'll look forward to regrouping with you when you get back. In the meantime, stay well and enjoy the south of France. I hope the rest of you will stay well as well, and that you will join us again, same time, same station, on Monday. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.